Here it is.
Got it?
Here we are. Got it nicely. Now, don't shake it. Here, Errol. Take one of the earphones. Yes. Earmark, take the other one.
Yeah.
Now then, listen.
Hello, CQ. This is 2-Emma-Talk. 2-Emma-Talk. This is 2-Emma-Talk calling. Is that all right, Ash? What? I'm blasting. Hello, CQ. I'm blasting. Do you have a blast? I blast a whole lot.
He didn't have any discretion at any stage of his life. And the fact that he could be so gloriously indiscreet was one of his attractions.
What? What you say? Oh, it's not going out at all. Are you quite sure? Well, it's your fault. For heaven's sake, then connect it up. Well, it isn't. Oh, it is. Hello, CQ. This has all been going on. I'm sorry, there was a big misunderstanding. A little bit of a technical hitch.
He was between Liberal and Labour, you might say. The sort of reader of the New Statesman, you know, of those days, really. With sort of rather rough, hairy tweeds. Baggy trousers, quite untidy, really. Very nice and very ugly, really, he was.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the so-called star of the afternoon, Captain Eckersley himself.
His first love, his second love and his third love was broadcasting. Of course, at the beginning of the BBC, you were never at home, or practically never. I don't know what a good father is, but he wasn't a normal father by any manner of means. But I always thought he was wonderful.
Captain Eckersley, the word is yours. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, your president referred to me as the so-called star. Not, I think it's perfectly rightly called. I've always thought so.
Not so much a star as a shooting star. When Peter Eckersley joined the BBC in 1923, listening was a quaint hobby, often involving crystal sets, indulged in by a few thousand. When he left, only 6 years later, the BBC reached an audience of millions. Radio was a national passion, and Captain Eckersley was a celebrity. The man who had made much of it happen, the engineer who explained the wireless over the wireless, and did it with all the panache of a natural broadcaster. Ironically, only a dozen years after he left the BBC, the very medium that had made him very nearly destroyed him. He was born into a dissenting family. His mother was the daughter of T.H. Huxley. Peter was raised in an atmosphere of intellectual debate, further encouraged by the progressive atmosphere of Beedale's school. At Beedale's, with brother Tom, he discovered radio. His son, Miles Eckersley.
Now, Tom was very clever. Later, fellow of Royal Society. And he was a physicist. So he was the one that actually started the interest in radio. I think it's been beautifully described by Peter in a recording of how he actually came to start to be interested in radio.
My brother Tom, he was standing on the porch, winding a very black tube with very green wire. And I looked at it and I felt it and I said, what are you doing? Oh, he said, this is wireless. And from that moment, and particularly when I went up into the schoolroom above and found, polished brass balls with great sparks tearing between them, when I saw lovely, acute, ebonite instruments with needles flowing gently over a scale, the whole tactile feeling of that lovely thing so engrossed me that I said, well, I must be a wireless engineer.
It was very precocious and at that time extremely unusual, and indeed even now would be unusual to be quite as interested in playing about with wireless as he played about with it at school.
Asa Briggs, historian of British broadcasting. When the Great War came, Peter Eckersley showed no enthusiasm for uniform. His mother, however, thought otherwise, and he found himself in the Royal Flying Corps. Much of the RFC's job was artillery observation, cruising through enemy flak while spotting for the guns. Here, Peter's knowledge of wireless was valuable, but it sometimes redoubled the hazards of what was already a pretty hair-raising life.
Extraordinary thing in those days is that they had to carry batteries. And these batteries were a flipping nuisance. And in the aeroplane, as you imagine, acid floating about. So he said, well, why don't we have a little propeller on the wing to work it? So they fixed this thing up, but it was huge. The thing's about 3 feet wide, the propeller, on the top of the wing. And they took off, and the plane began to shake. And eventually the thing disintegrated. In fact, they almost crashed. And it only just landed by turning the engine on and off. So he nearly died at that stage. However, out of that came a small propeller, about 6 inches, which was used later on the Vickers Vimy, which went across the Atlantic. So that was one of Peter's first sort of inventions, right?
A natural reaction to cock-ups in the sky was a certain amount of tearaway behaviour on the ground.
Oh. Do you want to know that he got into trouble with a local girl?
Oh, yes.
Right. Well, he and a friend of his went on a bit of leave, and they met this girl, and they spent the night away. Consternation in the camp. And then the CO hauled them up and said, "What on earth were you doing?" And Peter said, "What on earth do you think I was doing?" And and then that was a major, you know, black he put up, because you just didn't do that, you know. Officers didn't go off with dance girls, and especially spend the night out at the camp, you know. So that was the first show of Peter, I think, being a bit wild.
Peter's reputation preceded him. At home, his mother, a determined lady, decided to put an end to his wildness. The result was marriage to Stella. Sometimes opposites attract. Not this time. Peter's daughter, Joan Legrand.
Oh, it was most unsuitable marriage. My mother came from a village called Penn, and I think he found the atmosphere, the peace, the beauty of the place, sort of, that was his England that he was fighting for. I think there was some romantic notion. I always wondered how they got on together. I could never think what they talked about. I mean, my father was intellectual, left-wingish-ish, not very. My mother was a country girl. Horses, dogs, yeoman farmer descent. And she was quite different and very conservative. In fact, it was a most unsuitable marriage.
They did marry, and he then got posted to France. He was a captain by then, and he came into the Second Battle of the Somme. And the place that they were at was overrun. They took off, and he crashed. And he was hospitalised, and he never flew again. He lost his nerve completely. And my mother used to describe how he woke up at night screaming, you know, often.
The horror of those days never left him. Neither did his rank. He remained forever Captain Eckersley. And like so many of the demobbed, he had no trouble getting a job. His knowledge made him an attractive proposition to Mr. Marconi. Eckersley, at only 28, became head of the experimental section of the designs department. Nothing more than a long, low hut in the quiet of Chelmsford. And so it began.
"1922, and reaching out, as it were, into the vastnesses of space where, who knows, the earliest broadcasting programs may still ripple faintly through the ether. We'll recapture them and bring back to you the first voices.
Hello, CQ. This is 2M Talk, Rittle testing. Hello, CQ.
The voice of P.P. Eckersley calling from the Marconi Experimental Station at Rittle near Chelmsford.
1, 2, 3. 3 long paces takes me across 1 small wooden hut in the middle of Essex. And here I am talking to Robert Hawes of the British Vintage Wireless Society about what really a lot of people have said is the place where British broadcasting was born, in this little ex-army hut. Why Rittle?
Well, Rittle, because it was very near the place where Marconi set up his factory to make military equipment and later domestic receiving sets, and where, of course, the transmitters were set up and all the experiments were done. And this little hut at Rittle was where the special experiments went on for what later became BBC broadcasting.
The Rittle phenomenon came about in a curious way. The few hundred, perhaps thousand, owners of wireless sets were tremendous enthusiasts. They wanted a regular weekly broadcast to help them calibrate their sets, and they petitioned the authorities until Rittle got a license. What nobody expected was that the broadcasts would become great entertainment, because Eckersley turned out to be an irrepressible entertainer.
Tonight, we have a most marvellous thing that's going to happen. We are going to receive Rome. That famous Italian tenor, what's his name? Gridlico, is going to sing Non puto furore fantissimo, which being translated means... it's very difficult. Now we're going to receive it. There may be some atmospherics. There may be some jamming. Pa, 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 pa. There may be some oscillation. Whew! But hang on, CQ. We're just going to receive it now. Hang on, CQ. Hang on, CQ. Here it is.
Wrote from miles away, even from Scotland and from the south of France, in praise of the programme, saying how much they enjoyed it. More, please, they said.
He must have been quite amazed at the transmission range, though his transmitter was not strong.
Well, exactly. He was broadcasting with a 100-foot aerial, which is pretty short by any standards, and he was using a power of 250 watts, enough to power a few light bulbs. Modern transmitters are 1,000 times that power, and yet Eckersley managed to get to the south of France with it. This was a really remarkable thing that many people couldn't understand at all.
British broadcasting begins, November the 14th, 1922.
This is 2LO, the London station of the British Broadcasting Company calling. 2LO calling.
By the end of 1922, 2LO was on the air every day, while Radio Rittle was still only doing half an hour on Tuesdays. Often, Eckersley spoofed the BBC's output, but that was just fun and games for a handful of listeners. He was still a Marconi man. Then, luck took a hand. At least according to Captain Eckersley.
I was walking towards a bus, going to Liverpool Street, and I suddenly said, "Lord, I'm running tobacco." I turned back, I ran into a man, Basil Binion, who said, "Lord, you're just the man." I said, "I know I am, but what for?" He said, "Would you like to be the chief engineer of the BBC?" I said, "Well, I don't know why you people haven't asked me years ago." He said, "Well, you would like it." I said, "Yes, well..." Next day I was sitting in a cupboard with Reith. That was his office. That was the first office that Reith had. He had to have one by himself, so he chose a cupboard. And on February the 3rd, 1923, I was chief engineer of the BBC. Obviously the chief, because the only engineer.
The fact that Reith himself had been brought up as an engineer didn't mean that he knew anything about broadcasting engineering. So, to my mind, he delegated almost the whole responsibility for broadcasting engineering to Peter Eckersley. Reith always regretted that he'd had an education as an engineer. Eckersley would never have felt in that way at all, because he saw the creative power of engineering.
The challenge that Peter Eckersley faced can be summed up quickly, but that shouldn't disguise its sheer size. First, reception was often bad, weak or distorted or suffering from interference. Second, coverage was poor. Many people simply couldn't hear anything at all. Third, the Postmaster General, whose permission was needed for any change, preferred to move slowly. Nevertheless, Eckersley and his team made astonishing progress.
July the 27th, 1925. Opening of the BBC High Power Station at Daventry. Daventry 5XX reaches 23 million listeners. Station 5XX heard clearly throughout the whole country. And here now stands the world's biggest broadcasting station, with a power of 25 kilowatts, speaking from John O'Groats to Land's End.
You shall hear their lightest tone stealing through your walls of stone, till your loneliest valleys hear the far cathedral's whispered prayer, Daventry calling. Daventry calling. Daventry calling. Dark and still.
His greatest achievement, of course, was to create the regional scheme of broadcasting. Broadcasting started with low-power stations. Peter saw that it was important to have some high-power transmitters. He also saw that it was important to have a national programme which could be heard everywhere, but that listeners should have a choice between that and a regional programme. And therefore he devised the system of the dual transmitters, high-power dual transmitters. He was involved in the opening of Daventry, which provided the basis for the first national station. He was involved in the opening of Brookman's Park, which was the great transmitter outside London. He didn't like the way in which the regional scheme developed its content as distinct from its organisation and structure, because he didn't think it was being used sufficiently creatively. He would like to have had a genuine contrast between the two programmes. He would have liked more informality in the system. But for the technical side of the creation of the regional scheme, he and his colleagues were, I think, directly responsible.
In the studios, programmes were still being made in a pretty simple way. And whenever Peter Eckersley was around, the spirit of Rittle reappeared. Not even the BBC's director of programmes was safe.
Burroughs, dear Arthur Burroughs, the late Arthur Burroughs, great man, nice, charming person. He used at the end of the Sunday programmes, he used to say, the cares that beset the day shall fold their tents like the Arabs and silently fade away. Now, instead of relying upon a clever engineer to fade him out very gently, he walked backwards over the silent floor of the studio so that the last away was lost in a mush. And one time, a rather naughty and skipping friend of mine, he and I had a conspiracy in which we stretched a string across the studio behind Arthur Burroughs and silently fade.
Practical jokes never got in the way of Eckersley's achievements. Inside the BBC, he pioneered tremendous technical expansion, and nobody could touch him when it came to explaining those changes to the listeners.
This is London calling. Here is the chief engineer who's going to give you one of his technical talks.
Good evening, everybody. I'm going to talk tonight about fading. Fading is probably one of the most important things that one's got to consider in this whole art of wireless. You see, when a station has a particular radiation, it sends it out along the ground. Now, those waves are the waves that you want to receive, those waves along the ground. But unfortunately, a wave has sort of aerial ambitions, and shooting up skywards, it impinges on a thing we call the heaviside layer. Now, the waves that go out from the station to the heaviside layer do not suffer the attenuation they have when going along the ground. I mean, you know the sort of attenuation you suffer when you're going along the ground. You fall over...
He did other things, too, which were of fundamental importance. First of all, he did take a very critical part in the discussions with the post office, which had a very powerful control over the way in which broadcasting developed, and with foreign broadcasting organisations and post offices, which, in a period when there was a shortage of wavelengths, did have a very considerable control of the operation of the system. And he was the person who took part in those discussions. There was one meeting when he was there, and Reith said nothing for 2 hours and left the game entirely to Peter Eckersley to play.
As a delegate to conferences sorting out the jungle of wavelengths, he saw how radio was run abroad. It made him restless with the caution of the BBC. Eckersley wanted more daring. He wanted controversy in broadcasts. This was not allowed. Eckersley soon created controversy, but not in the way he hoped.
I think it was the combination of technical knowledge and an extraordinary lively and vivacious personality that put him into the forefront of BBC politics in the very early years of the BBC.
One of the most dramatic occasions that I can remember was there was a debate at one of these halls where people have a debate. Was it Conway? Who knows? It was a debate about communism. And all the comrades were there. And over the air, at the end of it, when there was a perfect riot, came the red flag sailing through the respectable British ether. Came the red flag in all its fury and all its glory. And what a row there was about it. And there you were, you see, suddenly aware that this power, this medium was something so terrific that that could be suddenly made aware to millions of people who probably never heard of the Red Flag, never heard of communism, or except as a sort of denigration. Yes. And that was one of the most dramatic occasions that I can remember. And, of course, the general strike. It was interesting because, as chief engineer, I had very little to do. And they gave me the job of seeing the news as it came in, and naturally I gave myself the job of hearing it as it came out. It was a little different. And that was the first time that I realized that perhaps this dream of mine, and it was a serious dream, that we had in the BBC a power which was independent of communal psychology, independent of current opinion, that which would be wise, witty, informed and cultured, was suddenly seen to be an instrument of government.
Whether, in fact, Peter Eckersley would have been entirely happy inside the BBC once it had ceased to go through the great experimental phase is a very open question. Reith himself wasn't all that happy in it. But certainly the BBC, when Eckersley left it in 1929, was a very different BBC from the tiny organisation when he first joined it. And one of his greatest achievements, of course, was to build up a staff of engineers. And they were the people on whom he depended. And they were the people who, when it came to the crisis, really felt that he had to go.
Whose baby are you, dear? Whose baby are you?
When he left, his going made national headlines. The Daily Mail gave it the best part of a full page. Captain Eckersley resigns from the BBC. What it didn't say was precisely why. A year before, he'd met an actress called Dorothy Clarke. To make matters worse, her husband also worked for the BBC in the music department. Peter could never be discreet. He and Dorothy virtually paraded their affair, even when he went abroad on BBC business. The only person who didn't know what was happening was Stella. Reith knew, Ashbridge, Eckersley's second-in-command, knew, and Dorothy Clark's estranged husband definitely knew. Irene Carpenter, wife of Eckersley's best friend and mentor.
Mr. Clark came over to the table and said, "Hello, Peter, old boy, how are you? So nice to see you," and chatted away full of joy. And when he left, Rupert said to Peter, "Well, that was very odd." And Peter said, "Odd? No, not in the slightest." He said, "No human being was ever more grateful to another when I took Dorothy off his hands."
You give the ring to to be true blue. Who is saving up his dough to buy a little buffalo? Who's loving up?
Nobody else was happy about it. Reith's diaries show that he consulted colleagues, brooded, agonised for months before deciding that Eckersley must go.
30th January 1929. Much exercised about PPE's affair. I had him in my room from 5 to 7.15. Then he rang me up at home at 8.30 and came there with the woman at 9 o'clock. Both he and the woman talked appalling rot and seemed quite immovable. She is thoroughly bad.
Many of Peter's friends and colleagues were devoted to Stella. And that, I think, put them on Stella's side in these circumstances. So you can't just describe the divorce easily in terms of convention.
Reith offered to pay Peter's debts and to increase his salary if he would break off this relationship. And, that was the worst thing to do to Peter, to try and bribe him. And even though he wasn't terribly enamoured of this Dorothy, he said, "No way. No, I'd rather leave."
Board, 2.30 to 4 o'clock. They do not want Eckersley to be a consultant, even. 6th May. Eckersley's resignation was announced last night. There was a great fuss about it this morning. We stopped him giving any press interviews, but he is acting in an abominable way and not really responsible for what he is doing. I lunched unwillingly with him today.
And he went off with Dorothy. My mother packed for him and said goodbye, you know, and that was really the last I saw of him, except occasionally. I think about four times since I was aged 6 to 30. I saw him four times.
Epilogue by Lord Reith.
The BBC was very fortunate to have him as its first chief engineer, and relations between himself and me were always happy and friendly. I remember making this remark at the farewell party for P.P. Eckersley. Don't forget those who went first, even if those who come later go further.
After he left, Sir Noel Ashbridge, well, Noel Ashbridge took over. Peter always called him Bumface.
He got the knighthood.
I know he did, and Peter sent him a telegram congratulating him and saying, I bet you were as surprised as I was. Mm. A very nasty thing to say.
What now? Where did a top radio engineer go when he left the BBC? The BBC was radio in Britain in 1929, which wasn't a particularly happy year to go looking for a job anywhere. What's more, Eckersley now had two families to support, though Stella had to go through the courts repeatedly for alimony. But he had great optimism, expertise and fame. He made money from journalism, set up his own lab in Garrick Street to develop new ideas, and throughout the 30s he travelled the world as a well-paid consultant. He kept his new family in some style in Swan Court, a luxury block conveniently near Harrods. His stepson, James, found life always interesting.
The earliest memories I have of my mother and PP were very left-wing. I remember that one of the star events was when Maisky, the Soviet ambassador, was invited to a cocktail party. That was the kind of atmosphere. Although most of his work, as far as I knew, was done at the lab in Garrick Street, he would do paperwork at home, and he would sit in his room, the door shut, and one had to be very quiet. And later, when he'd gone out, I would see foolscap sheets covered with logarithms and diagrams and his big ivory slide rule on the table in front of where he was working.
What he was working on was wired wireless. With others, he set up a company, Rediffusion. The concept was simple. Avoid the problems of airwaves and the cost of receivers by sending the programs by wire, what today we call cable. It wasn't popular with the BBC, who saw loss of control, or radio makers, who saw loss of profits, or government, who disliked change. Peter was discovering that great ideas got nowhere without great power behind them, and that hurt.
You know, I'm not going to talk about it, you know that I have deep down in me the feeling that a great deal could be done to improve the signal-to-noise ratio, even of the VHF, by using wires where wireless serves now. But I will not go into that. It's a vexed question.
Another vexed question was his second marriage. Dorothy was a fanaticist. She veered from one obsession to another. Communism, fascism, Zionism, vegetarianism. She denied her husband both red meat and sex. He spent more and more time away from home, working as a consultant in the burgeoning business of commercial radio. It took him all over Europe and eventually to Germany, employed by one Bill Allen.
This mysterious man, he arouses a lot of interest because, shall we give his pedigree, he was a Tory MP for Londonderry, he was an Ulsterman, and he had an advertising hoarding business, a millionaire, a lot of money. He also had an interest in Oswald Mosley. The Allen Company was a banker for the BUF, British Union of Fascists.
Oswald Mosley's fascist party was in desperate need of money in the late 30s. Commercial stations like Radio Luxembourg were highly profitable. Suppose a similar station could be set up elsewhere. Eckersley, with Bill Allen, searched Europe for a suitable site and found one in Germany. They were joined by Mosley's second wife, Diana.
We drew up a very careful protocol. One item was that there was to be no propaganda on this station of any description. We were not even going to have news. It was just going to be comedy, sugary music, classical music, if anybody fell for that. Rather like in the war, there was a thing called the Forces Programme, which was really so boring you couldn't listen to it. But, I mean, people loved it. It was purely commercial, and the Allens were going to do very well out of it. So was Eckersley, and so were we. It had to be kept very secret. I must tell you that, because, you see, if advertisers had thought it was going to partly be paid toward my husband's politics, they probably would have cried off.
Who did the negotiating? Peter was the technical side, and he had to negotiate with the engineers and that kind of side. The Allens were there to give a sort of weight, but Diana did the sort of, you know, the female touch to get the thing going.
I asked Dr. Goebbels, and I thought once he was really against the idea. I talked to Hitler, wasn't the least bit interested either way, though I kept saying what a lot of money there was in it for foreign currency. And they put me onto the sort of equivalent of our postmaster general, a man called Ohnesorge. And he immediately saw what a clever idea it was. It must have been in the middle of 1938. And they were busy designing it, Peter Eckersley and the Germans together. They got on very, very well. He said he was delighted with them, and they thought he was brilliant. And then, of course, the war came. So it never came to anything. But, I mean, that was the story of me and Eckersley, because really, that was how we became friends.
Dorothy Eckersley had moved to the far right, beyond Mosley's brand of fascism, and now supported Hitler. So just how friendly was Peter Eckersley towards Nazi Germany in the late 30s? His stepson James has no doubts.
He liked to be free. In almost every way, he liked to be free. I really don't believe that political commitment meant anything at all to him. I think that his whole formation was deeply liberal in perhaps a rather old-fashioned sense of the word, and that people doing things and pushing frontiers back and putting the world straight, whether they were on the left or the right, were people that I think he rather admired and felt he had something in common with.
By now, their marriage had fallen apart. Politically, Dorothy's fascist views were more than Peter could stomach. He never lacked for girlfriends, either because of Dorothy's coldness or because of his own appetite, who can say? But the bitter fact was he'd lost two wives in 10 years. In 1939, Dorothy moved to Germany. She enrolled James in a Berlin school. Peter stayed behind.
They telephoned each other in I suppose, late August 1939, and she said, "There will be no war." And he said, "Oh, yes, there will." And she wouldn't believe him. Whether she didn't want to believe him or whether she really believed it, I don't know.
"Germany calling, Germany calling, Germany calling. Here are the Reichsender ambush, station Bremen and station DXB on the 31-meter band. You are about to hear our news in English." The diplomatic correspondent of the Italian...
Daily Mail, 12th of March, 1940. Ex-BBC man's wife talks on Nazi radio. Mrs. P.P. Eckersley, wife of Captain P.P. Eckersley, former chief engineer of the BBC, is working for Dr. Goebbels. She edits, writes, and broadcasts herself for the Nazis in Berlin. Her son James, aged about 16, has also broadcast...
Bang. Peter was finished, really. He was interviewed by Special Branch. Here he was in a very tricky position.
Dorothy's broadcasts on German radio were more than a shock. They were a disaster, especially to Eckersley's prospects of war work. He'd been on the verge of getting a job with Robert Watson Watt, the father of radar. That hope died. Because of his wife, Eckersley was insecure, in every sense of the word. Then he met another woman. He was always meeting new women. Ironically, another Dorothy Carrington, young, attractive, vulnerable.
We were thrown up against each other by the storms of misfortune. We'd both been very unlucky or inept in our sentimental lives, and we were alone and harassed, and the war had started. He had a wonderful gift of empathy with women, and it was very consoling to me, because my self-confidence had been literally smashed at the time by the then prevalent view that women were only good for flower arrangements but could never do anything serious with their minds. That seems almost laughable now, but it wasn't laughable then.
Peter and Dorothy Carrington were good for each other. He encouraged her to write. She helped him with his autobiography, The Power Behind the Microphone. And suddenly, all his inventiveness came back.
I was banging away on the typewriter. Then suddenly he seized a piece of paper off my table and started scribbling, I can only call it scribbling, mathematical formulae. And this was an invention for scrambling speech between an aeroplane and the ground, which had come into his head. I don't know how. It's a sort of miracle.
There were no miracles in Eckersley's private life. Dorothy Carrington met a much younger man, an artist, and married him. Now, Peter's sense of failure was absolute.
My sister won't agree with you. She won't allow you to say this. Or she hoped that I wouldn't, but he did, in fact, have two attempts at suicide. In fact, he'd gone far enough, you know. He'd gone down the road. But he pulled himself together, eventually, and he went to psychologists. In fact, the reports that exist talk about all sorts of things, about his First World War, where he thought he had all sorts of problems with his nerves and so forth, and he might be considered a coward, also that he was doomed to failure.
The failure was never total. Peter Eckersley was too resilient for that. The invention, whose birth Dorothy Carrington had witnessed, a type of scrambler phone, was a success. It got taken up by the Telephone Manufacturing Company, and oddly enough, it appeared in the film Dr. Strangelove. By then, Eckersley had joined the company. That's where he spent the rest of his working life. It was all a far cry from Broadcasting House. Was he ever truly happy after the BBC?
I don't think he ever visualised, I mean, if you're leaving an institution. But he did say in one of his letters to me that he thought he would have become extremely pompous, probably had a knighthood, and he wouldn't have been a bit nice if he stayed on at the BBC.
I've often thought about BBC programmes, and I've often thought of those early days, and of course one gets captured by nostalgia, and this is a moment when one is a bit overcome with anecdotage. But at the same time, I do think that before administration and organisation overtook the BBC, there was a certain naturalness that although it was perhaps not so beautifully regulated, not so suave, so polished, so dressed in spats as it may be today, nevertheless there was a spirit that came over of people trying and of possibly not succeeding, which to me, as a listener, is much more exciting than almost anything else.
When he was in hospital the last few days, he was still inventing something, and it was pages of algebra, and he was sitting up in bed doing pages of algebra, trying to work it out, and he was very frustrated he couldn't.
He wrote his own epitaph.
He wrote his own epitaph. I don't know whether he thought it was an epitaph, but I think we decided it was, because I read it in one of my letters. But I think he suggested it. God is not mocked, the proved proof remains, the mind accepts the words, the heart disdains. I think it's very nice, that.
Peter Eckersley, the engineer with the soul of an artist, the man who helped the BBC grow faster and further than anyone else, died on the 18th of March, 1963. For those who grew up with the first years of radio, his voice was unforgettable.
Dearest, the concert's ended, sad wails the heterodyne. You must soon switch off your valves, I must soon switch off mine. Write back and say you heard me, your distance and where and how. Hark, for the engine's failing. Wow, 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 wow. Good night, CQ. God bless you and keep you. I can't. God bless you. Good night. Good night.